This is Wade Rathke. That means it's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30. We're on KABF with Wade's World. We live stream www.kabf.org. By Monday, we'll have a podcast, and you can listen to the show or re-listen or tell your friends. You know, KABF is 100,000 watts of people power, the voice of the people, broadcasting from Little Rock, Arkansas, distributed by the Affiliated Media Foundation Movement. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and we're talking to my old friend and comrade Charles Koppelman, who I know from years back, and he's done many films, but today we're talking about, can you believe, Charles, an opera? What in the world? About Cuba, Cubanicon. Welcome to Wade's World, Charles.
Thank you, Wade. Great to be here.
Great to be here. So I'll go from my great depth of experience with opera. I saw your picture in the New York Times having done an opera in Cuba, and you wrote the story. You were a librettist.
I wrote the words.
Okay, fans, Wade's World, librettist. You hear what that is. We're going to learn about opera today, Cuba, whatever. What in the world is this about?
This is about, well, first let me back up. This is the first new Cuban opera to be created and performed in Cuba in 50 years, which I didn't realize when I started it. And that was 12 years ago, actually. And it began...
Wait. Are you telling me you've been working on an opera in Cuba for 12 years?
Correct.
Wow. Okay, I didn't want to interrupt.
No. It's hard to believe.
This is like a lifetime project. You have children almost, younger than this job. Okay, go ahead.
This story is about, well, it's art and politics in Cuba, and it's based on a true story. Get this. Fidel and Che are playing golf in 1961 on the Havana Country Club, and there
Fidel
are pictures.
Fidel Castro.
Yes, Fidel Castro.
Che Guevara. This is for somebody in the very rurals of Arkansas or Louisiana or whatever who doesn't know Fidel Castro. Longtime president of Cuba, and Che Guevara, revolutionary hero. You've seen him on a t-shirt somewhere near where you live.
Or a coffee mug
or someplace. So they're playing golf.
And there are photos. You can see this moment was documented of them playing golf. It was kind of a lark, kind of a goof. They're out there with their entourage. Fidel in his fatigues, looking kind of awkward, probably never held a golf club before, ever.
And, you know, reportedly was a little bit negative on the golf game.
Well, it was a game for the rich and powerful, and that's what makes the story so remarkable. So they're playing golf, and as they play, so the story goes, they discuss what to do with the country club, because all the rich people had left. And it's a suburb of Havana where, you know, it was the good life. And they're all gone. Courses abandoned. Houses are abandoned. What are we going to do with this abandoned golf course?
And it's an 18-hole course? Or?
Oh, full. Beautiful course.
Oh, okay.
Palm trees, country club, the whole bit. So as the story goes, Chase says, well, let's build housing. We need housing. We need more housing for
housing
the people.
Housing for the poor.
Exactly. And Fidel, they thought about it, and so the story goes, they, you know, knocked the ball around a little bit more. Fidel says, no, I want to do something more, I don't know, meaningful and international. I want to build art schools.
Art schools.
Art schools for the people. The most beautiful art schools in all the world. Internationally, people will come from all over the world, students, to study here in Cuba. So it was decided. And the next step was, well, we need an architect. And through a friend, they found a gentleman named Ricardo Porro.
Ricardo Porro, okay.
And
was he a famous architect at that time, or just known in Cuba, or?
He was young and not very well known, but had supported the revolution, had had house meetings, actually, before the revolution, and was warned that he was on the list prior to the revolution. Batista, the dictator, was rounding up, quote, revolutionaries and supporters, and Porro was told to get out of town because he was going to be arrested.
So there's patronage even in a revolution. That's important to know.
That probably played a part, but it also happened that he was good friends with a friend of Fidel's, and Fidel was driving along the streets of Havana and spotted Selma Diaz, who was active in housing and in development. He stopped the car, apparently, and said, "Salma, do you know an architect?" And she said, "I know an architect. They'll be perfect for this." And so Poro was hired. He was given a very tight deadline. Build the schools, design them, build them up, get them up in, I think it was a year, 10 months, which is impossible.
Wow. Yeah, sure, sure.
So he brought in two friends, two Italian architects, Garatti and Gottardi, who lived in Havana, to help him. So that's what really happened in real history, in real life.
And how in the world do you happen a dozen years ago to know this story, Charles?
I picked up my hometown paper, San Francisco Chronicle, which I read diligently, and there was a column in there by their urban affairs writer about these schools and this architect and this exhibit that was on in San Francisco about that story. And something about it just grabbed me. Maybe it was the picture of them playing golf on the golf course, because I used to play golf when
there
I was
you go.
Younger.
We'll keep it to the us in the audience then.
Clipped the article and went to the exhibit on the last day it was open. Just by fluke, I looked
at it. It was over in San Francisco.
In San Francisco.
Okay.
Went to the show, small gallery, and saw blueprints and photos and read the narrative, and the light went on. It was
just blew you away, huh?
Yeah, this is, I gotta do something with this. And as you know, I often, normally, make films, documentaries, features, and try to figure out how do I make a film out of this, because it was too strong to let go. I bought a book, did more research, kept thinking about it. This is not a film, but it's got to be something. And one day, literally rereading this book, Revolution of Forms, by an architectural historian, the light bulb went on, and it said opera, because you have big historic figures, Fidel, Che, huge important moment in history, the revolution. You have these art schools that represent the art forms of opera, music, dance, fine art. Let's make an opera. And of course, I've never done anything like that before, so I had to figure it out.
So are you? Were you an opera aficionado at that point? Therefore, this click, click, click?
Not even.
I'm still missing.
I know.
A bridge too far for me. I hate to tell you how many things I could see in my life before it never occurred to me to say, oh, that's an opera. There's an opera waiting to be made. But okay, so we'll just suspend disbelief and say, okay, so you had this light bulb literally over your head somewhere in San Fran, or... And how you'd researched it for how long at that point? A year or 6 months?
I think that had been 6 months or so of thinking about it, rereading this book, which was a wealth of information and detail, and struggling to, you know, do something with it. You know, the heart beats. It's
sure.
strong. So I'm not an opera fish.
But it's Cuba, and it's a dozen, 11 years ago, and it's not like you can say, okay, I'm going to jump over to Cuba and, you know, hit some doors, talk to some people, talk to them about an opera, and, you know, we'll be rolling. So, Cuba, opera, now what?
Oh, I didn't go to Cuba right away, actually, which I think, in the end, was a blessing to wait. Very difficult in those days to travel. Could be done.
Yeah, I mean, it's only recently, we're talking the last 3 to 6 months, that it's even loosened up at all. So,
correct.
You have to have permits and educational purposes and a certified group. And
that's one reason I ruled out a film, because I knew it would be hugely difficult to do a film. And it took me quite a while to figure out the opera and get a group together of collaborators and a creative team. In fact, I went through one team that fell apart for a lot of complicated reasons.
Was one of them the pitch that said, hey, I make movies, I've never done an opera, but come on and help me do an opera?
Because no,
you would have had to, you know, practice that in front of a mirror for a while, too.
Yeah, but, you know, it's surprising. People, just like in the film area, if you have a good idea and you're passionate about it, people will
pay attention.
Well, because everybody's looking for something new.
Speaking of something new, we're talking to Charles Koppelman today, who has been the producer and wrote the, you know, the text for an opera that's getting a lot of publicity called Cubanicon. So we're trying to figure out opera, Cuba. This is a great story, Charles. Okay, so you had a team to help you finally. You assembled
that. Yes, I assembled that. I went to Cuba basically with nothing at that point, and that was about 5 years ago, with just an idea. And
Habla Espanol?
No.
Oh, we don't know. We want to make as many barriers as possible. We don't want to make this easy. Okay.
Correct. This wanted to happen, let me tell you.
Yeah, this was a passion project.
So I met with a musical consultant advisor down there, and she suggested a number of composers, and one of whom I met while I was there, Alberto Valera, listened to his music, loved it, liked him a lot, felt we could work together. He wanted to do this, and we made an arrangement. And so it started 5 years ago in terms of really in earnest making the music and the words come together.
So when did you finish? I mean, so 5 years, you finished just recently? Because I know, hey, I should have probably said this in the beginning. This is getting a lot of play in the New York Times. I was reading the paper early one morning, and all of a sudden, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a picture of my buddy Charles Koppelman sitting there looking like Joe Cool with somebody in Cuba. I thought, flip that page back. And then I reread it, and I said, whoa, okay.
So, the question is what?
The question is when did you finish it? How did you then get it to reality?
Okay, so it really was finished in terms of ready to be produced about 4 months ago.
And very recent.
And
as the thaw started to come in, so that must have been encouraging for you.
Well, it was just lucky break. In fact, there was total coincidence. And I started this time not having any idea what was going to happen with U.S.-Cuban relations, except knowing someday there would be a change. But
someday, sure.
I wasn't dependent on that.
So you'd originally assumed you would produce the opera there or here?
Didn't know. Whoever would take it. No, you do this stuff on spec.
I see that now. Okay.
I was ready to put it on whoever would have me. And people had suggested Cuba, but I thought that was going to be very difficult. And about a year ago, on a visit to Havana to work with a composer, the head of the Havana Biennale said, would you be ready a year from then, which was just this last May 2015. And of course, we still had maybe a half hour music to write and a bunch of libretto to revise, but I said yes, because as a producer, you always say yes, we'll be ready, with my fingers crossed. Now the Havana Biennale, I should say, is like a major international arts and culture event that happens in Cuba. Well, a Biennale means every 2 years, but it's Cuba and things are difficult, so there it happens every 3 years. In Venice, that's the big Biennale, it happens every two. There's one in New York, they're all over the world.
Yeah. You read about it sometimes. I have no idea what they do or how they do it, neither probably do our listeners, but we're with you on the story.
Well, I think of it as a giant art fair where people come from all over the world to see what's new, and in some cases, what's being performed. It's pretty unusual to have an opera shown at a Biennale. But again, Cuba, things are done differently. And this friend, who developed to be a friend, runs the Biennale, runs a fine museum in Havana, and said, come and do it. So we had to hurry up and finish. And from the time we started production to actually build a theater outdoors, which is where this was shown, hire everybody and put it on, we had about 7 weeks.
Wow.
Which is pretty insane.
So you were down there this whole period of time? Because I know you live in Berkeley in the Bay Area, right?
Exactly. On and off over the last 5 years, but more intensely since February. Pretty much every month. The last trip for this production was there for a month.
Crazy.
Yeah. Intense.
So, but you did get it finished in time. By the New York Times, I mean,
yes.
they seem to say you did put the show on.
The show was put on. We did three performances actually at night, outdoors. We had about 400 or 500 people a night. Many Cubans, good mix of Cubans, Europeans, Americans, a lot of Americans because travel is now easier. And we got a great reception.
And I'm also reading that there are other cities that are interested now in seeing what this opera might be like. And those, some of those cities are in the U.S., no?
Correct. There's a lot of interest in Los Angeles and in the Bay Area here in California and in New York. In fact, I'm going to New York and Washington, D.C. next week as the opera salesman with my package under my arm to meet with some really key people at some important venues. So the idea is Havana is just the start, and it goes from there.
So is it expensive to put together an opera in Cuba?
Good question. It's different.
What did you find?
Well, it's expensive to produce an opera because of all the arms and legs involved, so to speak.
Well, you're talking about building a stage, hiring people. I assume, you know,
full orchestra.
It may have been a labor of love for you, but I don't know if it was a labor of love for the composer.
Oh yes, no. He was paid. Everybody is paid. This was done on a Cuban budget. And the standard of living there, of course, is very different from Europe and the U.S. So it's affordable by our standards.
Well, that's fortunate.
It is fortunate, and I think that made it all the more sort of possible to do.
That's great. So the reception has been positive.
Very positive. People love the music, and when it comes to opera, it's all about the music. The words are nice, but no one really remembers librettist, and I don't take it personally. They come for the music. You know, you go for Mozart or Verdi or whoever, because that's what's...
And so what is the music like on this, then, Cubanacan? Is it, you know, like Cuban music? It's, you know...
It's very accessible. It's got a strong Afro-Cuban rhythmic heart to it.
Well, that'd be good.
It's been described by a couple of people as a kind of Cuban West Side Story, that it has that sort of popular feel, and it's not something difficult to listen to. We intentionally made it very accessible and lyrical.
Well, and that's a good thing, and obviously that'll build an audience for it. So this is going to be something we should follow and keep up with, because it's obviously going to be a story. And what is there a happy ending to this opera, or what happens to Fidel and Che school or buildings or whatever?
Right. It's a very mixed but overall upbeat kind of story. What happens is, due to needs of the revolution, the funding for the schools was cut off, and the schools were actually never finished. There are parts of the schools that were not done. But they were declared open and took students from day one and have been used ever since.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's good.
So it is very good. The sad part is, for example, the drama school, there's no theater. Okay. And the ballet school has never really been used because the ballet people never really liked the design. But the other schools, modern dance, fine art, music, used extensively and have produced some of the most amazing Cuban artists that you will ever know, and they're spread around the world.
Years is a rough period.
Part of my intention in the opera is to get recognition for the talent that's down
Great.
There, which
well,
is really, really strong, from the composer down to the performers. So the end of the story is the schools were declared open. They weren't completely finished. They were controversial because the style is very avant-garde, very organic, very erotic, actually. And the architect, Porro, was made to feel not at home anymore and left, went into exile in France, where he lived the rest of his life.
Oh, wow. And obviously the image of Cuba is not friendly to any criticism. And obviously, was this an exile for political reasons or just artistic reasons, or he just got a message under his door that said, Fidel says PU, or, you know, what happened?
It depends who you talk to. As they say in Cuba, it's complicated. And Porro himself, who I spent a lot of time with, said he chose to leave because there were no further opportunities for him, because he was kind of on a gray list as someone not to hire. At that point, the government hired the architects. Other people say he was pushed out. There are varieties of explanations.
Did he work in France?
Yes, he worked extensively.
Okay.
Yes.
So it all worked out for him.
It did work out for him.
And the... So there's sort of a little edge to this opera. How was it greeted in Cuba then on the political side? So you told us the fans loved the music, you had a mixed crowd, some Cubanos, I heard you say, but a mixed crowd. How about the official reaction? Was that...
Good question. No.
Thumbs up, thumbs down, Facebook, they're sending you a like there, they want to be on your buddy list, what?
No, it's a very good question. I mean, being invited to the Biennale and being an official project, this was the first, by the way, U.S.-Cuban co-production ever to be in a Biennale. To be invited and sanctioned officially meant we were blessed in that way, because it's operated by the Ministry of Culture.
Gotcha.
However, there's a lot to still be interpreted, and we put Fidel and Che on stage. They are in the opera as characters. That's never been done before. And from what I heard, people who are in the know down there, that may have been the most controversial thing, is that we put Fidel on stage and he sings. And believe it or not, that itself was very edgy. As far as the interpretation...
And of course, Che is the iconic figure of the revolution, huge 100-foot, you know, pictures, these are...
But with Fidel, they have made a point not to turn him into an icon, at least not while he's alive. So this was a bit risky, but they knew what we were going to do. And on the official side, the Vice Minister of Culture came to the final performance and afterwards greeted me and gave me a small speech, which is what they like to do. And at the end said, "Well, you've solved many problems," which is... hard to interpret exactly
right.
What he meant,
yeah.
But I think, and talking to my translator and my friends who were there, they said he probably meant you figured out how to tell the story in a way that was honest and authentic and didn't piss us off.
Well, this is something, we don't necessarily on Wade's World see ourselves as part of the, international cultural beat, but we're going to follow this story. We're talking to Charles Koppelman, who... telling us about the opera Cubanicon that just he produced and got to reality in Cuba. And is getting a lot of play and is a new experience for him. But maybe as controversial as a movie you told me you were working about people making $15 an hour. What are you talking about now? It's golf is one thing, but $15 an hour? Charles, what's going on?
Well, I try to cover my bases.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this film, At the Minimum, is what I'm calling it, I've been working on for almost 3 years.
9 years to go. Let's just keep...
yeah.
Maybe we'll get to 15 in 9 years. Don't tell me that.
I've been following a group of fast food workers nearby here in Oakland for almost 3 years, from their very first action. And they have let me into their lives both personally and as leaders and developing leaders, as well as their group in Oakland, where I'm just kind of part of the woodwork. I'm 15 minutes away, something happens, they get me on the phone, they get down here, and I hang out with them, and I've got an amazing, intimate, close-up look at this amazing campaign and these amazing people.
So is this just a front movie for the union, or what do we got going on here?
No, this is an independent documentary that I hope to get on Netflix, public television, whoever will take it when I finish it. And it should contribute to this discussion about income inequality and should contribute to the debates around this during the presidential campaign, because everybody's talking about it. But here are some actual people in 90 minutes where you can get to know and meet and really understand their lives.
And these are McDonald's workers, or what kind of fast food workers?
Yeah, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Taco Bell, the whole range. Yeah.
So obviously, McDonald's says they're not... I mean, corporate stores. Do they work in corporate stores or franchise
Both.
Stores?
Okay. Both.
So the corporate stores—that's an interesting problem. Say, you're going to make $10 an hour next year. I don't know what they're making now. Perhaps you'll tell us. I mean, they're making whatever the minimum wage is in California.
Just over eight. Yeah.
So just over eight. And what's the play between the franchise and the corporate? I mean,
in terms of the workers, total solidarity. They don't seem to divide at all along those lines. And the ones who got the raise,
some of them are getting $9 now, and some of them aren't.
Yeah, that's true. But they're all aiming for 15. They don't care. They're all dissatisfied, whether it's 8, 9, 9.50, and they're hanging in there.
Well, I've never met a worker who making 8 or 9 wouldn't be glad to make 15. So, that's a universal principle, I think. So, what do you reckon their shot is now?
Well, I think...
you've tried to follow this story past just the Bay Area, haven't you tried
yes,
to
correct.
Film elsewhere?
I've tried to stay rooted to these characters because I think... I'm not trying to do news, and I'm not trying to do, the top-down kind of story. I'm trying to do a bottom-up story. So you see the campaign and the issues and the struggle through a handful of people over time. And yes, they've traveled to Denver, Chicago, all over the country. And when I can, I get a crew locally to film them as they expand their work. But I think from what I'm seeing is that the strategy of city by city, county by county, state by state, that's paying off for them big time.
So there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal or Times, I can't remember, where they were interviewing the organizing director for SEIU, Scott Courtney, and ask him what kind of a deal he'd make on McDonald's if they just said, okay, we'll give you New York or we'll give you D.C. Would they settle and let the rest go if they could do it? And he seemed to be saying, I'm ready to make a deal. If somebody will approach us with a deal from McDonald's, yeah, it could be something like that. Is that part
of... You mean to give them a local in those places? A union or the raise?
No, we're past the raise now. They're talking about SEIU's interest is obviously getting a union.
Yeah. I haven't heard that. I don't know. I have no idea.
And I haven't heard it at all, but that's how he was quoted in the paper. So it makes it seem like it'd be one of those kind of situations that we've seen SEIU involved with elsewhere, where, I mean, like with the hospitals, HCA and others, take a couple of hospitals in this state, agree not to touch them in other states. Are your leaders getting a sense that they're under pressure now?
I haven't heard that, but you know, I'm not there every day.
Let us give you some questions to ask when you got the film rolling.
Yeah, listen, I've got some questions for you. Yeah, no, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, well, I mean, because obviously this is building up somewhere. I mean, there's more and more interest in living wages and these wages and the fight for 15 has become a slogan. And many people argue that the wage board in New York is the biggest point of leverage that the campaign has, so that if they could make a deal in New York, and New York's, it's not California, it's not the U.S., but it'd be a plum if you could finally get a huge organizing advantage in all of New York, they might be willing to settle. I don't know. This is just I read in the paper, so you know what the papers are like.
Well, Wall Street Journal, not sure.
Yeah, but Scott Courtney in quotation marks, you better believe that was really what he said.
Okay.
You know, they do have to check those things at the Wall Street Journal.
And not quote them out of context. They would never do that.
You don't get to, this is not the editorial page of the journal. This is the news pages. And it was, there are not that many places that have a labor reporter.
So what do you think would happen?
I think that if they could make a deal, one part of the country, they would take it.
And it's not a good thing or a bad thing?
It's an SEIU thing.
Yeah, but your opinion?
Depends on the rules of engagement on the campaign. But I would be surprised if they would walk away from a deal for New York if they thought they could get it. But we'll see. I mean, this could add some real drama to your movie.
It sure could.
The fight for 15 for them.
Uh-huh.
I mean, these are tough campaigns, but you've done lots of movies, so I know. Years ago, you did a movie on Acorn Squatting Campaign, which we still have posters from that movie on many walls in our offices. Of course, we don't have many offices anymore, but those of us who have them, we got them. And what was that movie about?
Squatters. Wow, that was my first film. Came out in 1985. Still in distribution, by the way. You can still see it.
Half 30 hour years among friends.
Yeah, really. Half-hour film. It was about the movement for housing in Philadelphia, starting in Philadelphia, where there were...
In fact, the Philadelphia story was like the subplot.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Squatters, the other Philadelphia story, where at that time there were 35,000 abandoned houses due to bad tax policy and city policies. And Acorn took it on and organized in the streets to occupy and fix up these houses very publicly, not hiding, doing it for the very public campaign to make the change. And I filmed, I guess that was a couple of years, and it was a thrill. I mean, that was a...
Well, and you've moved on. You're now, doing operas, and I'm still organizing squatters. We're just in Mumbai and Quito and Buenos Aires and whatever. Charles, if people wanted to find out more about CubaCon and your work and how to support it, because I know, you may be invested in art, but you're always having to raise a dime and a dollar. How do people get in touch with you? Is there a website? Is there an email?
Yes.
Tell the listeners what they can do to follow up on this.
Sure. There is a website. It's CubanaConOpera.com, and I better spell it because it's a tricky one. C-U-B-A-N-A-C-A-N, Opera, O-P-E-R-A, all one word, CubanaConOpera.com.
CubanaCon.opera.com. Thank you, Charles Kaufman. This has been Wage World on KABF 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power, the voice of the people, broadcasting from Little Rock, Arkansas. Next week, we're going to talk about the Tenderloin and a museum and a number of other things that are happening there about gentrification. Thank you from Wage World.